Beyond the headlines, this is World Insight.
Hello and welcome to World Insight. I'm in Boao Forum for Asia. I'm Tian Wei, coming to you from the glittering shores of China's Hainan province. The opening plenary of the Boao Forum for Asia Annual Conference 2024 takes place on Thursday. Zhao Leji, the chairman of the National People's Congress Standing Committee, delivered a keynote speech. He stressed the development of new quality productive forces, noting that China will adhere to the strategy of innovation-driven development, promote industrial innovation through science and technology, and speed up the development of new quality productive forces. At the Boao Forum for Asia, I had the honor to moderate three panels about new quality productive forces on the future of new energy vehicles, global AI governance, and also overcoming political hurdles to fix the climate crisis. These three panels will be brought to you later in our program. Also on the sideline of the forum, I talked to Stephen Orleans, the president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. Earlier, he attended with others Chinese President Xi Jinping's meeting with representatives of U.S. business and academia in Beijing. And here is his takeaway. After the great meeting between the Chinese President Xi Jinping and also the business and academic communities coming from the U.S., what is your takeaway from that meeting?
The participants in the meeting were very enthusiastic. First of all, it was a very relaxed meeting. It went on for quite a long time. It went on for an hour and 40 minutes. You've seen a lot of the, you know, CCTV has carried parts of it, walking into the room, sitting down, having the photo. That's all been carried. But the substance of the conversation was very good.
Meaning
that most of the people were CEOs of very big companies that have enormous stakes in China. And what they received was assurance about the Chinese economy, assurance about the investment environment, assurance that things were going to be improving. That President Xi talked about the resilience of the Chinese economy, the resilience of the Chinese people.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of agreement. You can see from some of the clips that CCTV has run is many of the CEOs were nodding their heads as the conversation was going on. But very relaxed, a lot of conversation about Secretary Kissinger. You know, obviously President Xi had enormous respect for Secretary Kissinger. He talked about when he was a sent down youth and Kissinger arrived in China and he wondered why that was happening.
Right.
And then he realized over time that what Kissinger did was historic, and he always believed in what President Xi said. He was absolutely correct, believed that Kissinger was right, and he was right then, he's right now, and he'll be right in the future. And that's my views and President Xi's views.
Talking about China and the U.S., President Xi did call on the U.S. side to walk toward the Chinese side in terms of cooperation on global issues and also regarding some of the controversies and challenges that both are facing right now in the bilateral relations. Your take on that?
He emphasized that it's important for the U.S. to focus on the complementary parts of the relationship rather than the conflicting parts of the relationship. And I think that's correct. It's, you know we have disagreements. We know we're going to continue to have disagreements. But there's so many areas that we can be cooperating on, and we should have meetings that talk about that cooperation. So rather than be criticizing each other, let's get together and talk about how we can combat climate change. Let's talk about where we can share technologies which will benefit the peoples of China and the United States. Let's talk about constructive things, and I think that's a fine idea.
Final question. He talked a lot about how the people of both sides could play its crucial role. Now, that goes to the heart of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. How do you see from your where you are to further promote this relationship at a very challenging time?
The meeting was a reaffirmation of what we do to increase people-to-people contact, that he would refer back to what he said to Bill Gates, that the people-to-people relationship is a foundation, and we need to be focusing on that. And I think the people in the room were supportive of that. there is neither government believes that people-to-people exchange is something bad. We all think it's something good. And it led to, you know, he said at the end, some of you is me and some of me is you. You know, a great Chinese expression. And what that was telling everybody in the room is, let's focus on the shared interests, where you and I are the same, rather than where you and I are different. Families disagree, but they're still a family. Societies have disagreements, but the society still remains unified. So I think that message got through to the Americans in the room very well. And when they left, we all got into vans, and we talked, and there was real great enthusiasm for the meeting.
You did not just get into the vans, you also get on the plane to right here.
That's right. Unfortunately, I couldn't sit in Beijing and enjoy the praise for the meeting. There was a lot of praise for the meeting from lots of people, and that's good.
Yeah. Good to see you, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Uneven growth is leaving the poorest behind, worsening inequality and stoking political polarization. That's according to the 2023 Human Development Report released by the United Nations Development Program, or UNDP. This resulted in a dangerous gridlock that needs collective action. The report is an important part of UNDP's work. On this and more, I talked to Akim Steiner, the administrator of the United Nations Development Program. It is a very exciting find out of the latest Human Development Report. Tell me how you and your colleagues have been preparing for this, and what do you think people should take away as the key message?
After the pandemic, for the first time now in 2023, we saw globally the Human Development Index recover. And that is good news. It shows that people, economies, societies, markets are recovering. But two very red flashing lights also in this year's Human Development Report, one pointing to an uneven and partial recovery, because particularly for poorer countries, least developed countries, low-income countries, that recovery is not happening. They are trapped in a post-pandemic, both financial and economic crisis, but also the inability to invest in the future. And that is an element of this year's report, also a very close look at the increasing polarization we are seeing within countries because of inequality, insecurity. We see a growing fracture in the political discourse in many societies, radicalization, but also, and this is also concerning at the global and international level, because the report repeatedly points to the fact that the world is bound to cooperate to address the great challenges of our time. And yet we seem to be seeing more and more tensions, geopolitical, but also more and more conflicts and crises. And this is affecting human development across the globe.
But what could be the solution to fix it?
The ability to cooperate internationally is a precondition for success, whether it is climate change, preparing for the next pandemic, whether it is the digital revolution and artificial intelligence. All of these are developments that require countries to work together. And this is why in the United Nations, but also in the Human Development Report, we are pointing towards a number of areas where we need to recognize that there are global public goods, and whether they are the climate-related ones, whether they are the digital public goods, or whether they're also the ability to bring more financing and investment, particularly to poorer developing economies. This is a crucial variable, because what we also observe and highlight is that post-pandemic, many countries have exhausted their fiscal space. They are deeply indebted, and many countries are now paying more in interest to service their debt than they're able to invest in their education or health sector, never mind in a cleaner energy infrastructure or a digital public infrastructure.
You see some of the emerging economies, developing countries, China included, trying to work on that. But now, with a fragmented world, many issues very hard to push forward. There were also setbacks. So from your perspective, how is the backdrop of geopolitics providing all these complexities? Do you think, as an organization of yours, aiming at development, could be doing something at least to begin with?
Two things are particularly concerning. First of all, we have more conflicts in the world in 2023 than at any point since the Second World War. And that also explains we have, you know, well over 100 million refugees, internally displaced peoples. Economies are essentially being driven backwards. Take a country like Yemen, take a country like Ukraine, like Afghanistan. The loss in human development there is sometimes measured literally in decades lost. And this is one area in which clearly it is very difficult for the UN to simply step into a conflict. It requires a great deal of international cooperation, we are seeing that eroded because of the geopolitical tensions, whether it's in the Security Council, whether it is in the General Assembly. In that sense, the UN is a mirror image of where the world finds itself right now, disrupted with a lot of tensions. At the same time, what we also see is that domestic policies and how governments responded to the pandemic, how they're investing in addressing inequality, how they're addressing, for example, decarbonization, the investment in digital access, affordable access, can also fundamentally change the trajectory of a country's development path. And this is why the report is not only describing the challenges and crises, it is actually focused on the opportunities that are there. But it is a world that at the moment is not seizing them. On the contrary, it seems to be drifting apart, and we are losing our ability to actually tackle these issues.
You have seen what we are facing today, one challenge after another. Where you are sitting would know more even than I do about that. Do you feel frustrated? How early was the frustration? And now how do you digest these frustrations and turn them into energies to focus on actions that can change at least a bit by bit?
Well, let's start with a very simple human phenomenon. There is a lot of misperception and a lot of misinformation in the world today. The Human Development Report has a very interesting illustration when people were interviewed across the world and asked, how much would you be willing to invest yourself of your own money in addressing climate change? 70% of the respondents said, I would be willing to do that. When you ask the same group of people, what do you think others would be willing to do? They said, well, maybe 40% would be doing or willing to do something. And here you have a classic example where people will not act because they think others will not act. We have to address a lot of misperception, misinformation. We have to also get people's confidence and also understanding that in this day and age, for example, with climate change, nations are bound to work together. We cannot succeed alone. And that is why, for example, the investments in decarbonization, renewable energy are so vital. And this is particularly where wealthier countries must also step in to assist poorer countries to make that transition. We have a global energy economy. We have a global food economy. We are bound to, in a sense, drive that global economy together, or it will create a lot of disruptions. And this is partly where I think there is a lot of reasons to be frustrated, but let us also acknowledge on the renewable energy front, we just saw in 2023 a record year of investment, China playing a very critical and central role here, $1.8 billion invested in new clean energy infrastructure, but only 2-3% of that investment actually landed on the continent of Africa, where the need for energy and access to electricity is perhaps the greatest in the world today.
One thing is we have seen some interesting developments, some positive ones. For example, the UN resolution on AI governance and also the latest UN resolution on Gaza ceasefire. But many wonder whether this is just the cream on top, whether these resolutions will easily evaporate away.
The first thing we have to tackle, however, is a concentration in particularly in corporate terms of access and control of technology and markets. For instance, few people realize that the three top tech companies in the world individually each were larger than 90% of the countries with their GDP. So you can see an extraordinary concentration. Secondly, we have very few guardrails on the deployment of a technology that could fundamentally affect people, societies, public information, and also leave behind billions of people if we don't drive this development in a way that is inclusive. So I think the fact that countries have come together in the United Nations at this moment to put forward a resolution on artificial intelligence is a good sign. And frankly, we have seen a number of very positive developments, for instance, also in the Kunming-Montreal Biodiversity Framework, when China presided over the Convention on Biological Diversity last year, a groundbreaking agreement was reached. The world can collaborate, but it must look for ways in which to overcome the tensions and differences. And I think particularly when it comes to new technologies, we have to make sure that we are together as a world community, as a community of nations, because otherwise these technologies could lead to extraordinary inequalities, leaving billions of people behind, and that is no viable way forward.
From a Human Development Report's perspective, how do you see the growth of artificial intelligence? On the one hand, what are the policies to encourage technology to benefit more people? On the other hand, the AI governance, how that balance is being ticked right now. Are you satisfied with that?
I think no one can be satisfied with where we are at the moment, but that is in part because it is a very new and very disruptive technology, but one that is almost without precedent in the way that it will change the ability of humans, of nations, of economies to do things. So it carries with it enormous opportunity, but also enormous risks. Every technology can be weaponized, cyber crime, cyber warfare. We see these risks and dangers, and we need to be precautionary. We need to also have a preventive approach, because otherwise we will drift into a situation where technologies become, in a sense, instruments for a geopolitical competition, and that could be very dangerous for the world. At the same time, we know that AI is projected to, you know, create access to opportunities, whether data-based or in terms of market, employment, livelihoods, that are in many ways extremely promising. And our focus in UNDP is particularly to help developing and least developed countries to be able to right now invest in their digital public infrastructure. That is the foundation of how an economy can participate in this enormously rapid changing environment. So extraordinary opportunities, but without guardrails, without international cooperation, could also very quickly turn into an exclusionary technology and even one that could be weaponized.
Beyond the headlines, this is World Insight.
Welcome back. This is World Insight. I'm Tian Wei here on the shore of Hainan Province for Boao Forum for Asia. Infrastructure is the key to connectivity in Asia. On the Boao sidelines, I talked to Eric Berglof, chief economist of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. In 8 years of operation, the AIIB has become the world's second largest multilateral lender after the World Bank. They are on a very important green mission. Nature is the new infrastructure. Why is this so? Well, listen to my conversation with Eric. For AIIB, nature is the new infrastructure, and green certainly is a big topic related to it. Tell me more about the latest development.
What we want to think about is, when we say nature's infrastructure, is to use the full potential of nature. We know that nature can be useful for binding CO2 in the atmosphere. It can be useful for, you know, protecting against storms, protecting against erosion. There are a lot of things it can do, but we still don't know the full potential. And when we are thinking about nature and thinking about investment, we have to think about what can nature deliver, maybe before we start looking at cement and steel. So if we can use nature to, for example, prevent flooding, or we can prevent it from storms and so on, then we should use nature. Well, we have unfortunately very few examples of a really successful nature as infrastructure.
How come?
No, I think that it has been difficult to get nature projects implemented, because we need to value nature properly, and that's not what we're not doing today. We don't have the right tools for doing that. In this report that we just published, we do look at some new tools for valuing nature. We're applying it to a particular project in Inner Mongolia. It's a wetland, and looking at all the things that this wetland delivers, and we call it ecosystem services, and trying to look at that. And when we do that, use that tool that really takes into account nature, we get a very different view of the project, and we actually decided that this should really be expanded, this project, rather than kept at the size.
One of the things about doing, quote unquote, the nature as the infrastructure is it takes time. Yeah. Now, it's not about something you would be extremely happy about in 2 or 3 years. It in fact takes much longer time. So would there be enough cash, first of all, funding for that long-term vision? Mm-hmm. Secondly, will decision makers, especially coming from local central governments in different parts of the world, be able to be determined enough to do it during their terms in the office? And thirdly, where to do it, right? Because there are so many important spots of nature in the world. They are crucial for themselves, but also for elsewhere. Yeah. So all these are pretty much difficult to decide.
No, sure. It's complicated. We don't have all the tools we need yet. We don't have the markets for nature. We're actually organizing later this week a conference on, particularly on nature, and tying it also to climate and carbon. So all that needs to be in place. And some of these investments can yield very quick results. So some things like planting trees will take a long time, but you know, there are other things one can do that really helps in the short term. So yes, it needs a lot of coordination, a lot of bringing together different interests. But also for emerging and developing countries, this is a fantastic opportunity. A lot of these assets are in emerging and developing economies, and if we started valuing them properly, they would have get cheaper credit, they would have less debt burden and so on. So there's huge opportunities actually.
AIIB has been very keen to work with developing and emerging economies, even though your members are coming from all over the world, the so-called Global North, the so-called Global South. So tell me more about how do you see the economies in some of these emerging ones. China is an interesting example. Earlier, very fast growth rate, and now slow down, focusing more on innovation, new quality productive forces, and etc. How do you see economies like this evolve? What does that mean for your strategies?
Of course, there are a number of emerging and developing economies in the past that managed to make it to advanced economy. The problem today is that the kind of constraints and the pressures to really join that sort of world technology frontier where all the advanced economies are is more difficult, partly because the pace of technological change is much higher today than it was maybe 30, 40 years ago. Take AI and so on. But also the environmental and social constraints, what the climate change, biodiversity loss, social pressures, we have a lot of inequality in many of these countries. So how do we bring that about? Yes, you said it, it's in innovation is the key. That's the really determinant of long-term growth. We should remember that innovation for countries is not only about finding completely new things, it's about bringing things that have been done in other places, like China did very successfully. Now China, through these ideas now of new productive forces and so on, is trying to take even a step further to really innovate things that are new for the world as a whole. And that's a very major contribution. It has to be part of a growth strategy of a country like China.
And AIIB has been diversifying your portfolio, but at the same time to work with different stakeholders, including with the private sectors, on issues of common interest.
Yeah.
So how does that work for the private sectors? Because they are extremely important stakeholders these days, especially when we are seeing more fragmented world.
Yeah, no. So first of all, as you say, multilateralism, trying to solve things through negotiation, through cooperation, I think is really the key. And that's, of course, what the AIB is about. What we have said is that we want to have 50% private sector of all total investments. So, and that's the goal for 2030. And we are working towards that. And as you say, the private sector is different. You know, private sector requires different things. But what is very important to remember is that to really get the best out of the private sector, you need to have strong state capacity, a state that can regulate and make sure that procurement is done the right way and so on. All that is so critical to get the best out of the private sector. Mm-hmm. And we won't be able to solve all these challenges like climate change, like biodiversity loss, without participation from the private sector.
The other thing is about the debt issue. Now you hear from the rhetorics a lot that certain countries after building infrastructure or attracting foreign investors have been in the depth of debts. Now, some of them might be true, but the degree is questionable. Others might just be rhetorics than the realities. But having said that, though, for emerging and developing countries, what is the reality AIIB is looking at? Secondly, what do you think might be some of the good practices you have witnessed in some of the economies you're working with?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very real challenge. About 50 countries or so are facing very serious debt issues. And in a sense, it's remarkable that so little crisis has happened so far. And it tells you a little bit how more sophisticated these countries have actually become in managing their risks and so on. So that's the good news. The bad news is that we need to do something about these debt levels because it is crippling them. And particularly as we want them to do a lot of new investments in new, greener technologies and so on, we need to deal with it. I think what is essential, there's something called a common framework that was developed, particularly with the IMF at the core. I think the kind of set of procedures that were set out in that are very good because it kind of brings in all the interested parties. Of course, a problem that we have is that we don't have a very good framework for bring in the private sector, and that's where we need to spend more time developing that, because what happened over the last 20 years is that a lot of the what used to be government loans has instead become a private sector loans, and we need to find ways of dealing with that.
That's my conversation with the chief economist of AIIB. That's all the time we have for today. I'm Tian Wei. On behalf of my team, thanks for tuning in. Bye for now.